You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. When I first discovered a love of the strange and weird, some of my key interests were formed at an early age. The Yeti and Nessie, UFOs, ghosts, and one particular subject that I've always been fascinated with since, and terrified by, and that is spontaneous human combustion. Since I saw the photos of what remained of Dr. John Bentley, who was discovered in his bathroom in the town of Cowdersport, Pennsylvania, back in 1966, I have never forgot the feeling those photos left me with. Joining me today to discuss this case and some of the most notorious spontaneous human combustion cases out there is a man who has spent over 40 years investigating this phenomena, Larry Arnold. Larry and I discuss Dr. Bentley, Mary Reeser, George Mott, and more, along with some of the alleged causes and explanations for SHC. Please be aware that we will be describing the scenes in which these unfortunate people were found in, which some listeners may find disturbing. I hope you find our conversation as thought-provoking and as interesting as I did. But before that, as always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon, by clicking on the link in the show notes, or searching on patreon.com for Mysteries and Monsters. You can sign up for $4 a month, and thank you to my latest Patreon, Frank. As always, you can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also now get your Mysteries and Monsters merchandise by visiting mysteriesandmonsters.com and clicking on the links on the top of the page. As always, artwork for the show is by Dean Bestel, and the show is produced by Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is also delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's take a trip back to that terrifying moment I discovered the phenomena of spontaneous human combustion in the company of Larry Arnold, talking about some seriously perplexing cases. On today's show, I discuss one of the phenomena that hooked me as a child, as I stared open-mouthed at the photographs from the site of the death of Dr. Bentley. Spontaneous human combustion has confounded explanations despite the usual dismissal by using the wick effect as an explanation. Joining me to discuss this fascinating topic is author, investigator, and researcher Larry Arnold. Larry, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Thank you, Paul, for that delightful and forthright introduction. We appreciate your kind words. As we think you're going to put this podcast up around Halloween, this is the ideal topic for Halloween. It is spooky, frightening, terrifying, and just outright freakishly bizarre.
You can say that again. As I touched on in the introduction, Larry, I remember being 9 years old, and here in the UK, we had a magazine called The Unexplained, and it was like a weekly collection where you essentially built up an encyclopedia of the weird. So it covered cryptozoology, ghosts, UFOs, disappearing people, anything. And one particular week, the issue rather focused on Dr. Bentley's unfortunate demise. And I remember seeing that picture of what was left of Dr. Bentley and just being absolutely flabbergasted that something like this could occur. And obviously being 9 years old, Larry, I then became terrified that I too would become a victim of this strange phenomena. However, in the 40 years since I saw that first article, I've had a deep interest in this. What was it that hooked you? Because I know you've got an interest in paranormal and Fortiana. So for you yourself, what was it that got you so ingrained and delving into this frightening subject?
Yeah, it's a long story. It starts when we were back in junior high school. Pulled a book out of the library about UFOs. Amazingly, for reasons we've never understood, that book was on the shelf. And we read it. We were fascinated that some people were claiming to see these very strange craft in the air. Did a book report on it. And, you know, the classmates and the teacher were a little skeptical about it, you know. But it presented to us some facts that seemed to fall outside what mainstream science and mainstream thinking was considering in those days back in the early 60s. And as we proceeded through our engineering studies at Lafayette College and then left college and worked in the electrical engineering trade for a couple of years, we kept expanding our interest beyond UFOs into cryptozoology. And then we started reading some things about strange fires as well. And when we left the engineering profession, we knew lots of people were looking at ufology. Lots of people were roaming around the woodlands looking for, you know, hairy hominids. But we couldn't find anybody who seemed to be doing really serious research in spontaneous combustions. We thought, well, here's maybe a niche that we can pursue. If there's nothing to it, we'll find out quickly enough. And if by chance there happens to be some credible information about this bizarre nature of strange inflamings, we can pursue it beyond that. Mm. So we went to the Library of Congress. At that time, our introduction to this was in a book by Frank Edwards when we were in junior high school called Stranger Than Science. Mm. And Mr. Edwards had a chapter titled Incredible Cremations, and it dealt with the case of Mary Hardy Reeser, who was a Pennsylvania native, which is our home state.
Yeah.
But back in July of 1951, she had moved temporarily down to St. Petersburg, Florida, intending to stay there but briefly and come back to her home state of Pennsylvania. And Mr. Edwards said that Mrs. Reeser had burned up in a most bizarre localized fire that seemed to perplex the local authorities at the time. We did not know whether Frank Edwards, being a newspaper man, had basically made up the story to flesh out his book, or whether he was reporting a true to life factual event. We went down to the Library of Congress in DC and pulled out microfilm. Some of your podcast listeners may not even know what microfilm is anymore, but it was available at that time. And we pulled out the microfilm for the newspapers in St. Pete, the Tampa Tribune, and the St. Petersburg Times for July of 1951 to see if they had anything to say about this alleged strange flaming fate of Mary Hardy Reeser. And indeed they did. This was front page news at the time, and it turned out that Frank Edwards had reported the story quite accurately. This was an astonishing case where a 150-pound woman had overnight burned, including her chair, to a pile of rubble that weighed about 7 to 8 pounds. Surrounding combustibles such as linen on her day bed, stacks of newspaper near her sitting chair had escaped damage. And yet the body was reduced, as we said, to about 8 pounds of rubble that consisted at the time as being described as a few pieces of calcined vertebrae, a skull that had been said to shrunk to the size of a teacup or baseball or an orange, and one of her satin slippers and her foot. Everything else is basically powder. Got us really interested. Could this possibly be true? And how to explain this amazing localized incineration. At the time, there happened to be vacationing in St. Pete a world-renowned forensic anthropologist by the name of Dr. Wilton Marion Krogman, who in his long career had made a particularly in-depth study of the effects of fire on the human body. And he happened to be vacationing in St. Pete, got wind of the Mary Reeser incineration, and took a professional and personal interest in it. And the case baffled him. Years later, we had the great privilege of sitting down with Dr. Krogman and reviewing his recollection of that case. But at the time in 1951, he was perplexed by the Reeser fire scene for a number of reasons. There was the absence of the characteristic noxious odor of burned human flesh. In fact, the first responders at the fire scene described the aroma as kind of sweetish or perfume-like. There was that localized incineration that was relegated almost wholly to her body in the chair in which she sat. Perplexing Dr. Krogman was the fact that in a normal house fire, temperatures rarely exceed 1500 to 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. In his experiments using putting cadavers in retorts and seeing what the effects of fire would be under various controlled scientific conditions, he wrote and later told us that in his forensic practice, the only way he could get bone to actually fry, become calcined, basically burn to powder, was to have the cadaver in a retort at a temperature of 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 12 uninterrupted hours. Those conditions could not have been present in Mrs. Reeser's apartment in St. Petersburg, Florida, on the morning of or the night of July 2, 1951. Or the entire structure would have burned down.
Yeah.
3,000 degrees if some of your listeners don't know how hot that is, lava flowing out of a volcano has a temperature of about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're talking incredibly high temperatures here. Normally, a crematorium burns the cadaver at temperatures of 22 to 2,400 degrees for an hour to an hour and a half. And what comes out of the retort oven is not just powder, but bone fragments, which then are put in a cremulator that mechanically grinds the bone fragments to powder to be put in the urn to be given to the next of kin. And yet Mrs. Reese's body managed to burn itself more completely than can normally be accomplished in a crematorium retort. So Dr. Krogman was certainly correct in being perplexed at the time. He said, in fact, and we'll find the quote here, "I always end up rejecting the case in theory, but facing it in apparent fact." He called Mrs. Reese the Cinder Woman and said it could not have happened, and yet it did. That was our introduction to spontaneous human combustion, which is how history has always referred to this phenomenon of the human body becoming almost wholly incinerated in an environment that is otherwise largely devoid of external ignition source and external heat and flame damage. Still, we thought maybe this is just a one-off. Even the local officials back in 1951 were so perplexed. That includes the fire department, the police department, and certainly Dr. Krogman. And then the case presented itself to us that you found was your introduction to this amazing phenomenon, that of Dr. Bentley.
Yes.
Also in our home state of Pennsylvania, we got a tip that in northern part of Pennsylvania, up in Potter County, something that might have been similar to Mrs. Reeser occurred in December of 1966. We started making phone calls. We talked to the medical examiner, we talked to the coroner, we talked to the assistant deputy coroner. We found the first responder who actually discovered the fire scene, and some of them would talk only briefly over the telephone, but they all invited us up to Potter County, and they were willing to sit down and face-to-face with us if we were willing to make the trip.
Yeah.
Well, some researchers of paranormal phenomena, as you know, like to conduct their investigations from the comfort of an armchair. We like to get our boots dirty. If we think we've got a credible lead that's of interest to us personally, we'll get in the car, we'll get on our motorcycle, we'll go out in the field and sit down with the first responders, the people who claim to be witnesses to all kinds of Fortean phenomena, and get their accounts, get their experience firsthand, face to face. And that's what we chose to do with our pursuit of the Dr. Bentley alleged spontaneous human combustion case. We spoke to Don Gosnell, who was the gentleman who first discovered this amazing fire scene when he had laced up his boots to go out on his meter reading rounds the morning of Monday, December 5, 1966. When he walked into Dr. Bentley's home on 403 North Main Street in Cowdersport, Pennsylvania, he noticed a whitish-gray, wispy smoke in the hallway, which had an odd, sweet smell to it. Didn't think much more of it, proceeded down in the hallway, down into the basement of Dr. Bentley's home to read the gas meter in the basement. Before leaving the basement and turning around, he noticed on the earthen floor in one corner was a pile of ash about 5 inches in height, he told us, 14 inches in diameter. Being a volunteer fireman in Cowdersport, he walked over out of both an innate curiosity and professional training and response, kicked the pile of ashes with his work boot, and then looked overhead. And above this pile of ash on the earthen floor, he saw in the basement ceiling a hole about 2.5 by 3 feet in diameter with some cherry embers on its perimeter. His first thought, he told us, was, gee, there must have been a fire overnight in Dr. Bentley's home, but we wonder why we didn't get a call to come out and put it out.
Yeah.
Mr. Gosnell went back upstairs, and before leaving the building to go to the house next door to read its gas meter. Cowdersport back in the 60s was a small, very friendly community. Everybody trusted one another. And he knocked on Dr. Bentley's door to make sure that the 92-year-old retired general practitioner was, you know, alive and in good health. He got no response. The doctor's door was unlocked, so Don stepped into the two-room apartment, did not see Dr. Bentley in the living room. The only remaining room was Dr. Bentley's bathroom. When Don stepped into the apartment and looked around the corner into Dr. Bentley's bathroom, he saw of the photograph that you saw and described briefly to your listeners, which has become the quintessential poster child for classic spontaneous human combustion. Overnight, and we know this is for a fact, overnight, because he was last known to be alive at least 9 p.m. On the Sunday evening of December 4. This discovery was made the following morning about, if memory serves, a little after 8 o'clock. Overnight, Dr. Bentley had immolated in a very localized but apparently quite intense combustion event that incinerated almost his entire body, leaving behind perhaps his head laying on some water pipes below the bathroom floor, and one half of his lower leg still wearing its leather satin slipper. Everything else of Dr. Bentley had burned through the linoleum floor, through the oaken, almost through the oaken beams that supported that floor, and had burned itself to that pile of powder in the basement that Don Gosnell had kicked with his work boot.
Mm.
We subsequently went to that fire scene. We stood in that bathroom. It had a low ceiling, was 6 feet tall. We could stretch our arm upwards and touch the ceiling. There was not a scorch mark on that ceiling. Dr. Bentley was an invalid. He used an aluminum walker to help him locomote through the two-room apartment from his sitting room to the bathroom and back.
Yeah.
The aluminum walker was found askew atop that hole. The aluminum, which will melt at 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit, was intact. Just above the perimeter of the hole was Dr. Bentley's bathtub. The bathtub had been painted with enamel paint. We could chip off pieces of that blackened enamel paint. The paint itself did not blister, even though it was directly above the hole through which his body had cremated itself.
Yeah.
Dr. Bentley, as we said, is the poster child for what we prefer to call sudden human cremation, SHC,
yeah.
Or as history has called it, spontaneous human combustion, which is a little more difficult for mainstream science and forensic fire professionals to accept. But they cannot reject the photographic evidence, even though many of them would like to try to do so. We know the provenance of the photograph that was given to us to prove the historical validity and verify that what we have just described to your podcast listeners is indeed exactly what was found by Don Gosnell and his fellow firefighters in the morning of December 5. When Gosnell called in the alarm, in fact, he ran down the street in terror, rushed into his gas meter office and yelled the understatement of 1966, Dr. Bentley's burned up. One of his firefighters heard about it and went back to Dr. Bentley's home to see for themselves what Don had described to them. Don urged his fellow firefighters not to go in. He said it was just too disturbing. He refused to go back into the fire scene itself. This was just psychologically, you know, incomprehensible,
yeah,
and quite frightening, to, as it would be to many firefighters and to first responders. Mm. This is not what you're supposed to find at a fatal fire scene. You're expected to find a house that maybe was a smoking mishap accident,
yeah,
with a lot of surrounding fire damage to the body. Most likely the body would have asphyxiated, but you're going to find the body is reasonably intact, can be taken to a mortuary, taken to the morgue, be autopsied, looking for evidence of foul play or asphyxiation, whatever.
Hmm.
In the death certificate, this gets really interesting because here in Pennsylvania and likely in Great Britain and in anywhere else in the world, a death certificate is supposed to be a historically accurate documentation of cause of the deceased.
Yeah.
The reason the deceased transpired. In Dr. Bentley's birth certificate, it is marked that he died by asphyxiation with attendant 90% burning of the body. Now, if you had not seen the photograph, and if you had not sat down with Don Gosnell and his fellow firefighters, nor sat down with the coroner or the deputy coroner or the mortician, you would think that this was a normal fatal fire scene where the body could have been taken away and fully intact.
Yeah.
The way you determine asphyxiation in a death is to have the trachea, the esophagus, or the lungs to autopsy. None of those existed with Dr. Bentley. They had all been consumed completely to dry powder.
Mm.
As to 90% burning the body, as John Deck, the deputy coroner, told us, it was more like 99% burning of the body, which is accurate. So here we have an astonishingly bizarre and thorough human cremation that occurred in an environment in which the surrounding combustibles themselves remained undamaged. In fact, Dr. Bentley's home was literally a tinderbox of an environment. The whole structure at 403 North Main Street should have been burned to the ground. It clearly did not. So therein lies this incredible mystery as well as incontrovertible documentation that on rare occasions, the human body is capable of incinerating itself to a degree more thorough, more complete than can be achieved in the normal operating conditions of a retort crematorium.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that are quite interesting about both cases when we talk about Dr. Bentley and Mary Risa. I remember a few years ago, Larry, seeing an interview with Mary Reese's son, Richard, I think he's called.
Mm-hmm, correct.
And that's one of the sad things about this, especially the Mary Risa story, is that Richard was stopped from going into the house. He never actually saw the scene as it had occurred at the time, and only discovered what happened, I think, when the story was actually published in the papers, didn't he?
We believe that's correct. We had some communication, both written and verbal, with Dr. Richard Reeser. We desperately wanted to know as much as we could learn about his mother.
Mm.
We were able to meet with some other relatives of the family and get some background information, but But Dr. Reeser himself would have been the key witness, the key source for crucial information to help us understand more about Mrs. Reeser and maybe come to a better grasp of how to theorize or how to explain her remarkable near total human incineration. We got to the point where he himself finally was willing to meet with us and discuss the details of his mother's life with us. Sadly, Dr. Reeser's wife put the kibosh to that, and we never were able to explore in detail and to get the kind of information that we wanted. But the same thing happened in the Bentley case. Dr. Bentley's son lived in the area at the time. The local officials who knew how Dr. Bentley transitioned this physical three-dimensional world in December of 1966 refused to tell Dr. Bentley's son the details of the fire scene. He did not know how his father died until he and his wife were watching an episode of a program called That's Incredible on ABC television back in 1980. This is probably aired in British television as well.
It was the first time
that we documented to the public on television the remarkable, baffling burning of Dr. Bentley. And Dr. Bentley's son was watching that program that night, and that was his introduction to how his father transitioned.
Oh, my goodness. That must have been awful for him, Larry.
It was quite a shock. Quite a shock. Had we known that the son existed, we certainly would have attempted to contact him. No one told us until after that program aired, and Mr. Bentley Jr.'s wife contacted us. Did we learn that he actually had a son that was still alive?
Well, unfortunately, I think often when you've got cases like this, as with both the Reeser and the Bentley case, often, as you well know, Larry, they are pushed to the side, suppressed, kind of not wanted to be discussed in full, primarily, in my opinion, because of the circumstances. And once again, with Dr. Bentley and Mary Reeser, you've got situations where the night before their remains are discovered, they are seen by people in seemingly perfectly good health. I think Mary Reeser had been having drinks the night before with friends in the neighborhood and retired to bed, and that was the last time anybody saw her. Dr. Bentley, did he have like his home help or someone was round at his house till about 9 o'clock, and he was known as someone that would always welcome visitors popping in to see him and have a chat about the local issues?
Yeah, let's pick up on both of those points for you, Paul. With Mary Reeser, she was last seen alive about 9 p.m. the evening of July 1. She was believed to have taken 2 Secanol tablets, sleeping tablets, and she was left in good health sitting in the chair in her sitting room in St. Pete. With Dr. Bentley, he was visited by his caretaker, whom we interviewed, also about 9 o'clock that evening. According to Dr. Bentley's daughter-in-law, it was his custom to sit in his chair in his sitting room and watch television until 11 or 11:30 at night, and that's where he would go to sleep, in his sitting chair. When he was last seen alive, he was in good spirits. As we said, he was 92 years old, so he was certainly elderly. He had broken his hip a couple years earlier, which is why he needed the aluminum walker to locomote through his two-room apartment. But he was in good spirits. He was acute of mind. People have argued, the naysayers, the debunkers of SponCom, have argued that, well, because Dr. Bentley was an inveterate pipe smoker, he probably dropped a lit match or the pipe in his lap and caught his robe aflame and, you know, became a victim of clothing incineration, the ubiquitous, as you said at the top of the introduction, became a victim of the human wick, human candle theory explanation. We can talk about that later if you wish. But in the Bentley case, we talked to the newspaper editor as well as the other first responders, and the newspaper editor told us that when he went to the scene to write his story for the newspaper edition that would come out 2 days later, Dr. Bentley's pipe was in a holder in a stand next to his chair. Now, here's our argument against Dr. Bentley being the victim of a smoking mishap. If Dr. Bentley had indeed dropped his pipe in his lap and ignited his robe and looked down and saw the predicament that he was in, it's incomprehensible to us and to everyone that knew Dr. Bentley back then, that he would have reached into his lap, picked up the pipe, put it neatly in the holder next to on the stand next to his chair, and then hobbled with his walker to the bathroom in search of water to put out the fire.
Yeah.
His nurse told us that it took him many, many minutes to make that short distance with the walker. Being acute of mind, what he would have done if this was the scenario that was indeed unfolding, he would have simply stood up and got out of his blazing garment, dropped it on the floor, and he would have been okay.
Yeah.
We believe Dr. Bentley suffered his incredible human incineration once he got into the bathroom and was standing in front of the toilet.
Mm.
And that's where he literally did not burn up, but he burned it down through the floor, down through the oaken beams and into the basement below.
Yeah. I mean, it is a remarkable thing because the whole scene, Larry, makes you think that something had clearly made him. He may have, as you say there, he may have simply been going to use the bathroom. But it is peculiar, mm-hmm. as we often get in these cases where people, as with Dr. Bentley, as soon as you see that information in regards to the scene, that propose that he must have set himself on fire with his pipe. When anybody has an accident, if they are a smoker, be it cigarettes, pipes or anything like that, Larry, usually the last thing they care about is whatever they used to smoke. You know what I mean? The key thing is, putting themselves out. And for an invalid old man, as you say, who had to use a walker to move around his property, for him to basically calmly pick up the pipe or whatever he was supposed to have set himself on fire, I think matches were also put forward as an explanation, put them to the side, trundle into the bathroom, and then suddenly burst into flames. I'm one of those people, Larry, when someone gives me an explanation and I look at the evidence and I think, well, that just doesn't make sense at all, because, as you say, I think there was a plastic toilet seat as well that showed no signs of melting either, was there?
Can't speak to the construction of the toilet seat. We don't remember. This happened. We were back there investigating this in 1975.
Yeah.
The memory doesn't hold up. We probably think it was a porcelain seat or maybe a wood seat, but don't hold us to that. But we can say this because we have the photographic evidence for this. On the legs of the aluminum walker, which itself, as we said, was completely intact, were rubber tips on two of the four legs. Mm. So those rubber tips themselves lying above the hole through which Dr. Bentley's body immolated, those rubber tips themselves did not melt. The paint, as we said, on the bathtub next to the hole did not blister, and no damage overhead. One of our critics says, well, Larry, the reason these fires appear to be so isolated is because fire doesn't radiate horizontally very far. It burns vertically. Well, like, we don't know that. The first responders don't know that. Yeah, sure, they do know that. So then but given that as the fact in almost all normal oxidizing fire situations, why do we find no singeing, no scorching, no flame damage whatsoever on a ceiling that was literally 7.5 feet above the basement floor through which Dr. Bentley burned?
Yeah. Plus the floor as well, I believe, was tar-based linoleum, wasn't it?
Perfectly correct. You know the case very well. We conducted experiments. In fact, we did this for the BBC back in, I think, 1999. We got a piece of old tar-based linoleum, the kind that was on Dr. Bentley's bathroom floor. We laid it on wood planking, and we took a piece of ham shank that had a bone in it.
Yeah.
That we had marinated for a full year in a refrigerator in a solution of whiskey, bourbon, and brandy. We took it out of that solution, wrapped it in shirt fabric, laid it on that piece of linoleum, and lit it for the BBC to film. After a fairly lengthy period of time and an infinite amount of oxygen, the fire self-extinguished, and we had 99% of the ham shank tissue sample intact, unburnt.
How unfortunate.
We demonstrated to the BBC that the wick effect, so far as we could demonstrate, and this was not the first time we had done this experiment, we've never been able to get it to ash in the burn sample.
Yeah.
The field producer said he was going to go out and next interview John DeHaan, who in America is perhaps our best known fire forensics expert.
Mm.
He was going to demonstrate that the wick effect does indeed explain away all cases of so-called spontaneous human combustion. As we said to the field producer, if John DeHaan can indeed prove what he tells you he's able to do, that would be scientifically very important. But one thing, he cannot use any accelerant because in the case of Mrs. Reeser and Dr. Bentley and hundreds of others that we document in our book Ablaze, there is no accelerant present, even if it's been tested for it. None is found. So when the BBC airs its program about spontaneous human combustion here in America, what do we see John DeHaan do? He puts a pig, which is his stand-in for a human body, wraps it in a blanket, and then pours a liter of gasoline upon it before lighting it. It was a dishonest experiment then. He has conducted similar experiments since 1999, always attempting to prove that the wick effect explains away all these so-called cases that Larry Arnold and historians for hundreds of years have labeled spontaneous human combustion just cannot happen. He either uses an accelerant or the experiment goes absolutely haywire and creates an inferno that has to be suppressed with fire, you know, hoses and water so that the entire burn chamber doesn't burn to the ground. So repeatedly, he has proven on camera that the wick effect doesn't explain cases like Mary Reeser and Dr. Bentley. And yet he and others continue to persist and insist that there's nothing at all mysterious about these cases.
Yeah.
If these victims were the targets of careless smoking mishaps, we don't know the statistics for the UK right now, but in America, we still have about 2,500 people annually who die in smoking mishap incidents. They do not burn themselves to powder. As we said earlier, they can be taken to an auto morgue. They can be autopsied. They can look for, you know, evidence of foul play, accelerants, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You cannot find that in Dr. Bentley. You cannot find that evidence with Mary Reeser and with many other cases that we've been able to document over 40 plus years of researching this amazing phenomenon. Arthur Clarke once said that there's a mystery that he's asked about that bothers him more than any others, and that's spontaneous human combustion. He said that some cases still seem to defy explanation and leave me with a creepy and very unscientific feeling. If there's anything more to SHC, Mr. Clarke wrote, I simply don't want to know about it. And that's perfectly okay for Mr. Clarke. We have no problem with that. But you cannot look at the evidence that Mr. Clarke finds too distressing, too disquieting to investigate and to study and write it off as something conventional and mundane. That doesn't work. Elaine Pope here in the United States is a renowned fire forensics expert, and she claims that even with the most severely burned cadaver, if there is foul play involved, she can find it. She can find evidence in the remains of the body of stab wounds or a gunshot wound, something like that. We would challenge her and any other naysayer of SponCom to look at the evidence that Dr. Bentley left behind, that pile of ash and half of one leg, or look at the remains that Mrs. Reeser left for the world to marvel over, as did Dr. Krogman, a few pieces of calcined vertebrae, a shrunken skull, and a foot, and find evidence of foul play, of a gunshot wound, or a stabbing.
Yeah. I mean, it is perplexing for me, Larry, because often when people talk about this, the wick effect is one of those things that is often put forward consistently, as you refer to. I have never, and I've seen plenty of people attempt it, I have never seen anybody successfully complete it in the circumstances that are supposed to mirror a spontaneous ignition case, right? As you say, they either add ingredients such as wool or some other kind of fuel. They usually use an accelerant such as petrol or gasoline or alcohol, and they usually set it on fire. These are usually three things that we don't find in these perplexing cases. Often I've seen people just burning fat, not anything including bone at all. And I'm not sure how crematoriums work in the States, but I know over here in the UK, until recently, Larry, when they'd burned the body down and scraped all the remnants together, as you say, including the fragments of the bone, they're basically then pulverized by giant metal ball bearings to grind them down into powder. None of that, as you say, mirrors anything that tends to go on in a normal spontaneous combustion case. And I've heard you mention this before, that if it was this easy to cremate bodies, every crematorium in America would simply be using matches and alcohol to burn all their bodies, wouldn't they not?
Exactly. You're so perceptive and so astute, and it's so gratifying to hear someone look at this situation with the common sense that you just explained. One of our critics, and we have no problem naming these people because they deserve to be called out. Mark Benecki is another internationally renowned forensic biologist. His quote, quote, "There are no known cases in which internal organs of a burned corpse are burned more severely than the outer parts." On that basis, Mr. Benecki argues against any reality for any reason to believe in the concept of sudden human cremation or spontaneous human combustion.
Mm.
The problem for Mr. Benecki is he has to ignore the evidence and the facts that history wants him to look at and investigate as a forensic professional. Dr. Bentley left behind zero internal organs, unless you want to argue that the skin is an organ, which it is, and part of the skin was on his lower left leg. Otherwise, no internal organs were left behind. Mrs. Reeser, to the best of our ability to ascertain from all the interviews and all the historical records that we've been able to collect on Mrs. Reeser, and a file on Mrs. Reeser is about 2 inches thick, so we've done some research. She left behind no organs. So we have a recent case, the most recent case that we've been able to personally investigate happened here in the States in 2013. In that case, once again, localized incineration, almost complete destruction of the body. In this case, the upper shoulders and head were intact and parts of the lower legs were intact, but the torso was basically obliterated.
Yeah.
That gentleman left behind his heart. But again, going back to Mark Benecki, who says SHC cannot occur because internal organs are always left behind. Only the heart of that gentleman remained. No lungs, no pancreas, no liver, you know. So history proves the debunkers wrong. Let's just be flat out honest with what history shows, what history presents. If you don't like what history presents and it's too disquieting, just say, okay, I don't want to deal with it. I'll walk away and we'll let somebody else with a more curious mind look into it. Hopefully that would be someone like you. Someone like us, and hopefully most, if not all of your listeners to this podcast.
Absolutely.
When we were trying to follow up some cases that happened here in Pennsylvania many years ago, we went down to Philadelphia, walked into their brand spanking new fire headquarters, met with one of the senior fire investigators on duty that day. We'd just come from meeting with a fire marshal who had personal involvement with a classic spontaneous human combustion fire scene. So classic that in this case, we were able to lock down the time from the moment the victim was known to be alive until the fire department arrived to a fire scene that basically had no fire to put out. The time available for her body to consume itself was 6 minutes, 360 seconds.
Yeah.
The fire marshal, the fire chief, the assistant fire marshal were completely bumfuddled. They had no way to explain how a fire could have burned that woman as completely as it did in such a short period of time. When we went a couple miles down the road to meet with the fire inspector for the city of Philadelphia to try to find some information about cases that occurred in his jurisdiction, he flat out told us that he didn't have anything in his files to show to us. And our first reaction was, well, you know, this has been several years later. Maybe you've moved the files to a different location. If so, we'll go there. He says, no, Mr. Arnold, you don't understand. What you're asking about can't happen. Therefore, we can't have any files to show you. So simple as that. So we put on his desk the photographs of Mrs. Reeser, the photographs of Dr. Bentley, explain the circumstances as we've explained them to your listeners, and then we put on his desk the photographs of Mrs. Conway,
yes,
from whom we just met a few minutes earlier with Fire Marshal Meslin. He said, look, sir, you're the expert. We're coming in cold. We're just investigating this with a curious mindset. If there's a rational, conventional explanation, please share it with us. And end of mystery, we'll go find some other mystery to investigate. We said, what would you do if you were called to a fire scene and you saw something like these photographs depict? We shall never, ever forget his statement. Quote unquote, word for word. I'd go out, I'd get drunk, and I'd forget about it. At that point, he told us, pack up your stuff. And he ushered us to the elevator, down to the ground floor and out to the sidewalk.
I mean, the Helen Conway case is probably one of the most violent examples of this phenomena, Larry, that I've ever read about, seen. I've seen the photos of what happened. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the thing that makes this one so special in the realms of this whole crazy scenario here is, she'd asked, was it her granddaughter she'd asked to send to the shop and say, could you get me some cigarettes?
Mm-hmm.
And she'd literally gone to the shop, got her something, said, there you are, And then a passerby noticed smoke coming out of the window, I believe, called the fire brigade. Fire brigade turned up. And unfortunately, I believe, didn't the first person who came in couldn't see properly because of the smoke, crawled in, and unfortunately ended up putting his hands in the middle of what was left of poor Mrs. Conway?
You are extremely well-informed about this entire subject, and you've nailed that completely as we understand the situation ourselves. Let us read, we actually have the newspaper article in front of us. Let us read part of it for you and your listeners. Mm. The headline from the Evening Bulletin, November 9, 1964, headline, Widow Burns to Death in Drexel Hill. Here's the body copy. A Drexel Hill widow was burned to death shortly after 8 a.m. yesterday as she sat in a chair in her home at 527 Argyle Road. The victim, Helen A. Conway, 51, was pronounced dead at the scene by Dr. Paul Shore, Upper Darby Township police surgeon. The fire was confined to the second floor room in which her body was found. And then it goes on to say how two of her grandchildren were in the home at the time, and it's our understanding that the one grandchild, Stephanie, had been requested by Mrs. Conway to get her some cigarettes. She wasn't, you know, Mrs. Conway was a known smoker. And we believe that the cigarettes were returned and then Stephanie went back downstairs to watch television on Sunday morning. The adults in the family had left for church shortly before this incident occurred. And as you correctly say, the newspaper goes on to say that a bypasser noticed smoke coming out of the second floor window and the fire department was called and they arrived within minutes, a very quick response time. And the story goes, as you correctly say, the first firefighter into the second floor sitting room of Mrs. Conway went in on his hands and knees because the room was filled with black smoke. And he was on his hands and knees with his one arm extended, looking to find, you know, Mrs. Conway, because they all knew that a woman was in that room.
Mm.
And what the fire chief, Paul Haggerty, told us was that firefighter put his hand in something that he didn't know what it was, but it felt weird. And when they brought in the smoke ejection equipment, and he realized at that point that what he had put his hand in was the lap of Mrs. Conway. And we were told it was a very long time before that firefighter had the courage to respond to another fire call. It frightened him for a very long time. It was very psychologically disturbing for him. As we said, we sat down for we have hours of interviews with Paul Haggerty, the fire chief, Mr. Lott, who was the deputy fire marshal, and bless his heart, Bob Meslin, the at that time was the fire photographer for the department, later elevated to the ranks to become fire marshal for Upper Darby Township. We sat down with him in his kitchen and went through the dozen photographs that he took of this remarkable fire scene, went through the timeline. Every fire officer whom we interviewed on the Conway case said she had no more than 21 minutes from the time that she was known to be alive until she was found burned. Now, the newspaper article that we quoted in part gives no indication of the strangeness of this combustion event. It just sounds like a normal smoking mishap, you know.
Yeah.
You had to be at this scene. You had to talk to the first responders to know exactly how bizarre, how frightful, how incomprehensibly weird this particular fire fatality was. That's part of the problem with the research that we've spent a good chunk of our life pursuing. It's incredibly difficult to identify these very strange Fortean SHC events from a normal drop cigarette or arson murder case fire.
Yeah.
Because they're not reported accurately. They tend to be reported more accurately in Great Britain, we believe, than anywhere else in the world, which is why we have more cases per capita in the UK than anywhere else. But unless you get a firefighter who knows what you're researching and says, hey, Mr. Arnold, Larry, I heard about this fire that just didn't seem quite right to me, and maybe you'd like to pursue it. And of course we will. And we have pursued some that turned out to be conventional fires, albeit kind of strange. But then we find cases like Bentley and Mrs. Conway and scores and scores of others around the world that just belie common sense.
Yeah.
Refute what Dr. Benecki says, refute what Elaine Pope says about these cases, refute what John DeHaan argues must be a conventional, albeit a little strange, normal fire fatality, explainable and explained away as the wick effect. It just doesn't work for us.
Yeah.
As we said, we've conducted several experiments to try to verify the wick effect because we don't want a mystery monger, which is what one of our critics labels us, a mystery monger. We don't need to monger a mystery with this. The mystery is embedded in the facts of these remarkable fire scenes.
I think the Conway one as well is even more remarkable, Larry, because there's a couple of things as well, if I remember the scene correctly. Didn't she use a bell to ring for attention
And that was found kind of what... Because, I mean, the picture of Mrs. Conway is quite remarkable. And when you look at it, it looks... I'm just proposing something here. I'm not certainly trying to explain it. It looks as though she'd exploded. It looked like her torso had gone, because obviously all that seems to be left of her on face value, I think, is both her legs. That's it. And then on this chair that she sat in, there are two remarkably strange clues, you could say, if you could pull anything from it, which is this bell that she was known to use to ring for attention, I think. And also she used to wear a charm bracelet. Both those items were found on her remains, were they not?
You're absolutely correct, Paul. Absolutely correct. Yes. She used the bell to summon assistance, since I probably how she called Stephanie to get that pack of cigarettes for her.
Mm.
The brass of the bell is lying on her burned thigh. The brass is intact. The pine wooden handle on the brass bell itself is also intact. On her left wrist bone, on the ulna, dangling from the ulna is a charm bracelet. Her forearm burned right to the bone, literally to the bone. Now, there is some amount of torso and upper body left behind, but the photographs are remarkable because what you first see are two lower legs from the knees down propped up against the front of the chair. And it looks to us, as it looks to you, like the chair was forced backwards so that the body is pushed downward into the body of the chair itself.
Mm.
Looking up across her, where her knees would be, across her burned to the sternum breastbone, you can see an inverted V that still has a bit of wispy smoke coming from it. That is the bottom of her jaw. She was forced backwards. So you're looking, you know, basically into the base of her head, across her chest and across her neck.
Yeah.
Once again, no odor of burned flesh. No damage to the ceiling. If this is a drop cigarette, cigarette manufacturers are in for a hell of a liability lawsuit. You know, they're guilty of lots of things, but they're not guilty of producing a fire scene like you and we are talking about with Mrs. Conway.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I mean, for me, I think the most perplexing thing is when you talk about the timescale, Larry, it's 6 minutes. 6 minutes to reduce somebody to a pile of ash and some extremities. And then when, as we said there, when you've got a wooden-handled bell laid on the corpse, or what's left of the poor lady, for that to not be burnt at all, it's wood. You know, it's a flammable material. As we said, in the Bentley case, flammable material. He burned on a flammable material. It didn't catch fire. You know, Mary Reeser, there were flammable materials all around her. Didn't catch fire. That's not how fire works. I think we all know how fire will just burn as much as it can. And often, referring to the wick effect, I remember once seeing somebody try to demonstrate it, as you said, Larry, and the whole room, this room that they'd created, the whole thing went up. And everything was on fire and everything was melting. And he went, there you are. That's proved the wick effect. And I was like, no, it's not. That's the exact opposite of what's happening.
Yeah. John, going back to John DeHaan again. Comes into the subject with a high reputation, a lot of background information. He knows, got to watch our language here. He knows a lot about fire behavior. Give him credit. He knows a lot. But when it comes to this little niche category of these incredibly bizarre and very rare fire scenes, like we've been discussing this evening with you, all that expertise, all that scientific background just seems to go out the window. We have proof that Mr. DeHaan, in attempting to replicate the Conway case, he gets it wrong, but he claims he's replicating the Conway case, lights a handful of candles that he's wrapped in flannel fabric, lays it on a futon, and when the camera comes back, he's standing there. The fire has gone out. The flame damage is localized to this wad of melted wax wrapped in flannel on the futon, and he's saying, look, localized fire indicates and replicates, duplicates what Larry says is a scene of spontaneous human combustion, and it's no such thing. The problem with that is, and this was televised, the problem is that whoever did the editing edited out the portion where John DeHaan frantically calls in fire suppression equipment to put out a roaring inferno that was in within a few seconds of going full chamber flashover. And for him to come back then and into that fire scene where the roaring blaze has been suppressed with water, and to point to the extinguished charred area as proving the wick effect is simply dishonest.
Yeah.
Why he chose to do that baffles us. And the next time, should there be a next time when we meet with John DeHaan, we're going to ask him about that. Because it deserves an answer.
Yes.
If you're going to lie about the success, alleged success of your experiment has no value, nor does your argument.
I think one of the interesting aspects of this is that often people put forward extremely unusual explanations, regardless of this continued defense of using the wick effect, which is, you know, as we've mentioned, Larry, I think we've put that one to bed, literally. And when it's talking about strange phenomenon, I'm often very uncomfortable trying to use other unexplained phenomena to explain it. And one of the ones that often gets put forward, which I always find remarkable, that it seems to be a very interesting thing that it gets put forward for a lot of things, is ball lightning.
Okay.
Primarily because a lot of scientists don't think it even exists. Some do, some don't. And I've heard it put forward for explanations of the Fae, for UFO sightings, and also for spontaneous combustion cases. And yet, as far as I'm aware, Larry, the vast majority of alleged ball lightning experiments, these are very small things. They are not large things, and that, you know, we don't really have much documented evidence in regards to it. And one of the interesting aspects of your research is that you've looked into a lot of different explanations. I mean, I wasn't very aware of Kundalan as a theory and a train of thought, because obviously when you look at Eastern practices and Eastern beliefs, there seems to be a lot more sort of open-mindedness when they look at the body's ability to generate heat or how their belief systems work. So at what point during your research did you start to look into some of these more, I suppose, Western scientists would describe them as mystical explanations?
Yeah, wonderful question. Interesting observation as well. We certainly concur with your viewpoint that Eastern physicians and metaphysicians tend to have a broader viewpoint on the nature of physical reality than do most Western scientists, even to this day.
Mm.
Back in the 60s and 70s, we became involved in what would be called today, I guess, metaphysics. But we attempted to broaden our horizons, our level of consciousness, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, that led us into this whole realm of other things that might offer explanations, credible explanations, for these amazing localized human incinerations. So it got us looking at Kundalini, it got us looking at Ki, got us into quantum physics, got us into bioelectricity, got us into geography. We have a chapter in a book about the cartography of combustion, where you are at a particular time might be inflammatorily hazardous to one's health or to one's property. We did that in part because intellectually it was challenging,
mm-hmm.
and also because the database that we have now has some 500 plus cases that fit the definition of SponCon. We don't see any common set of factors that leads us to focus on one or maybe two singular hypotheses to explain these fires. The database, the case base, is so bizarre, so diverse, so varied, that we truly at this point don't believe there is a single causative mechanism that can explain the many vagaries,
yeah,
of the cases in our database. So we know we have colleagues who focus on one theory, and for them that's perfectly fine. But we've got bigger databases than we think they have. And for the reasons that we just said, if for nothing other than intellectual curiosity, we like to expand the possibilities. We have in excess of 120 theories in our book Ablaze to suggest mechanisms or means or situations by which these strange fires might be explained.
Mm-hmm.
We think some of the theories have great merit. Some of them are probably completely facile and worthy of debunking.
Yes.
But at this point, because the mystery is an open question, we think it's dishonest to say, okay, I'm going to immediately throw out this cause because this cause is impossible. But we've heard too many people in mainstream orthodoxy say that the whole concept of SHC is impossible. So we choose not to limit ourselves.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, for me, it's one of those where it's not a one-size-fits-all explanation, Larry, because...
Perfect.
Some people say, oh, well, lightning's caused it. But I've yet to see a case of lightning strike. And there are, you know, there are numerous people around the world who have had the misfortune, or some would say good fortune, to survive a lightning strike. They do not suffer anything like the victims that we've discussed today. You know, often they will have sort of burn marks that run across the skin that often looks like the veins in a leaf. I often find quite strange. Or it's conducted via jewellery or things like that, Larry, or it blows their shoes off. It doesn't cause sort of internal injuries. I know obviously it can cause heart attacks, but not to the extent that we're talking. And I know obviously lightning can cause fires, but nothing like what we're discussing at all.
That's been our experience as well, Paul. Roy Sullivan, we think, still holds the world's record for having the most lightning strikes and surviving the most lightning strikes of any human being. And I think the number for him is seven or nine lightning strikes.
Yes.
And whatever the final number is, he was still walking around and telling people about it. He wasn't a pile of powder like Dr. Bentley became, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, one of the theories that we developed that we think will be of particular interest to your listeners in the UK, because, as we said earlier, we have more cases of spawncom, both of property and of people, in the UK than in any other geographic area on the planet. We plotted them back in 1975 on a big map of the UK to see if we could find any patterns, because in Fortean phenomena, quite often the strangeness of the event will form patterns.
Mm.
And what we found when we plotted the location of scores of cases on a map of the UK, more than 80% of the cases we could connect by straight alignments running across the terrain. I'm sure that will invoke in the minds of many of your listeners, you know, Alfred Watkins' concept of ley lines, linking megalithic structures and sacred sites across the UK and beyond the UK.
Yeah.
But these alignments connected simply fire phenomena. And one alignment that roughly parallels the east coast of England and Scotland may connect as many as 12 cases of a very singularly strange event, i.e. sudden human cremation. In one of our research trips to your wonderful country, we had a concentration of alignments up in the Lincolnshire area, focusing initially on Binbrook. And you probably know back in 1905, there were some very strange events happening around Binbrook Farm, including spontaneous combustion events. So we went there. We actually went to the farm and met a lifelong resident of Binbrook, and he took us out to the yard walk where these events had actually occurred. And while we were there, one of the residents we spoke to suggested that in nearby Horncastle, there might have been a recent case that he thought could be spontaneous human combustion. So I thought, aha, we'll go over to Horncastle, which we did. And then we met with Fire Chief Officer Russell Danby, and he was able to convince us that this was a normal fire, not spontaneous combustion. But we did have the opportunity to sit down with him and show him some of the photographs that we've been discussing with you, and you yourself have obviously seen. And his first response was, surely this has got to be foul play. And we explained that it wasn't. And his next response to us was that there's nothing like this that I've ever seen. These photographs had to be made up, he thought. Of course, they weren't. So after we left him, and he thanked us for showing him some things that he had never encountered or even been taught about in his fire service career. We went next over to Lincoln to meet with the fire brigade commander for the entire shire of Lincolnshire. We sat down with Commander Shen, introduced ourselves, explained why we were there, that we've been following this track lines of combustion phenomena that led us to his jurisdiction, and maybe might he know of a case that would be of interest to our research. And Shenton's first response was, oh no, you know, that doesn't happen. What you're asking about simply can't happen. But then something really fascinating happened. He got really quiet and he pushed himself away from his desk. And as we sat there, it was like watching little gears cranking around in his brain. He was trying to recall something, and it was kind of like having a challenge to get through the brain mass matter out to his mouth. But he finally pulled himself back up to his desk and he said, you know, Larry, a couple years ago, and this is when the body still gets cheers for recalling this, he started to tell us about a fire scene that was in his jurisdiction that he had kind of forgotten about. And we introduced this case in our book Ablaze, and we're going to tell your listeners about it now, because maybe one of them can give us some additional information about this remarkable case. We do not know the victim's name, but it happened in a small area called Kirkley-on-Bane, and it happened to a hermit who lived alone in a literal tar paper shack of a hovel. The windows had oil paper as glass. He lived in an environment that was just filled with newspaper and other combustible materials. The neighbors said that they had not seen him in a couple of days. They called the authorities out. They walked into the house. They couldn't find him. They came back out and said, he's not here. The neighbors said, he's got to be in there because we haven't seen him in a couple of days. And knowing what we know about him, he's not someone who wanders away or travels any distance. He's got to be back inside that house. They went back in. They walked around. And finally, they discovered that, yes, indeed, he was in the house. And where he was burned largely to powder between two rows of newspapers themselves intact. As the fire brigade commander for Lincolnshire told us, and this is a quote, one thing that has always bothered me, and the more I reflect on this, the more bothersome it becomes, why nothing else in that place burned up in the fire. I mean, with all that newspaper, even oil paper on the windows, it was a tinderbox, exclamation point. And yet the combustion was relegated to that old hermit in Kirkley-on-Bane. If any of your listeners knows about this, we would love to know additional information. If there were photographs taken, he did not have access to them. And this is another problem. We often know that photographs are taken and the photographs are destroyed or never released to the public. In fact, in the Reeser case, when we last talked to the St. Pete Police Department in 1995, the Mary Reeser case that happened in 1951 was still an open case, but the department would not release photographs of the scene to us for scientific and historical research purposes. We did have opportunity to see the photographs later because we met with one of the police officers who had been stationed on the first day of his duty with the St. Pete Police Department. His job was to secure the external premises of the Reeser apartment, and he was given on loan temporarily a set of the photographs that officially we were told did not exist. So we have seen the photographs of the Reeser case. This is just another one of the challenges and the difficulties of the research that we do in this field. It is extremely difficult to identify these cases. It is even more difficult to pry loose the crucial historical and photographic documentation that we need to obtain enough information, gain enough insight to have a better understanding, to develop a better theory, a more complete hypothesis as to how these cases can best be explained, and therefore maybe someday prevent them from happening to other people.
Yeah, I think there are two examples that I can think of, Larry, that kind of clarifies this kind of issue we have with getting the evidence and dealing with this in an open mind. One's from the UK and one's from America.
Okay.
One happened in 1908 in Whitley Bay, which is in the northeast of England, once again, on the eastern side of the UK. And it was a lady called Margaret Dewar who came home to find that her sister had essentially burnt to death on a bed, and the bed was untouched. Her sister had essentially just died. The bed was unscorched. She was pressured by the authorities to change her story and accused of lying. Refused to change her testimony originally, Larry, until it went to the verdict. And then she changed the story and said she'd found her sister downstairs and carried her to bed, right? Once again, that shows that there is a train of thought going on here that we just need an explanation and we're not bothered if the witness statements contradict that. And then there's another one that sticks out to me, which I think happened about 20 years later, which was a lady in New York, I think, Nora Lake, who was found on a bed once again, and the bed was unscorched. She was found fully clothed. Her clothes were undamaged, but she was burnt to death. And the official explanation was she'd been murdered, set on fire, dressed, put in bed to cover a robbery. Now, both of those examples are two of my favourites because, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, Larry, when somebody gives me an explanation like that, I just go, no. I'm not having that at all, because that just, I'm incredulous, because that just goes against even basic common sense, doesn't it?
It does indeed. We discussed at some length the Margaret Dewar case in our book Ablaze. Everything that you said about it, we have documented historically too. Yep. It's interesting how the authorities, the people that you and we would think would be most intellectually and scientifically inquisitive about these strange fires, because these cases are not like chasing down Bigfoot or looking at a light in the sky and saying it's an extraterrestrial coming to visit us from the Pleiades.
Mm.
that's all speculation. And until we get some really good Bigfoot hair samples or something, it's still speculation.
Yeah.
What you and we are talking about in this podcast is absolutely confirmable by historical eyewitnesses and photographic documentation. The photographs that we have in our book and that you have seen are not photoshopped. We know the provenance of these photographs. We know the circumstances under which these photographs were made. We're, as we said earlier, we're not mystery mongering here. These are real, live, bona fide mysteries that demand open-minded investigation.
Mm.
And the pressure that comes from orthodoxy to cover up these cases, to misrepresent them, or to force a witness to change her story, as happened to Margaret, just belies scientific integrity and everything else that you and we expect of officials who are supposed to be curious and operate from within a scientific methodology.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating to us. And yeah. We wish we didn't have to deal with it, but sadly, that's the case. These cases are so xenophobic, and they so belie what experts have been taught and think they know and want to profess as their niche expertise, that when something so radical comes along to challenge their belief structure, they cannot deal with it. When we went down, as we were wrapping up research for our book Ablaze, we went down to the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland, premier educational fire academy in the United States. We happened to encounter three senior instructors that day. The first one in the hallway, we handed him photographs and said, if you have some time, we'd like to sit down with you and get some of your expertise. His response was, well, yeah, I've kind of heard about this, but I'm not really interested. And he walked away. We identified the second gentleman, and before we could even hand him a photograph, he said, I don't want to see this. And literally, we are not exaggerating, he ran down the hall away from us. That scene happened to occur in the purview of the third senior instructor on duty that day. He came over, he looked at the photograph, he said, come into my office and tell me everything you know, because we don't have a clue. Now, that is the kind of response that we would hope to have encountered with every fire official, every cremationist, every scientist who has ever been introduced or heard about this subject. Sadly, people like that third instructor at the National Fire Academy are few and far between. Even some of the officials who have had firsthand experience over the decades have found it more comforting to change their story and say, oh yeah, Mr. So-and-so dropped a cigarette on his lap and that explains it all away. I don't have to think about it further. That's okay for that individual, but that attitude will not advance scientific understanding.
Yeah.
And it will not prevent this phenomenon from happening to others in the future. Whatever causes this, or whatever factors, plural, causes these sudden human cremations to occur, to present themselves, has a long history. We've traced this back, we believe, for thousands of years. But it is also extremely rare, which is why it is so easy to deny the evidence and the facts of the situations that present themselves historically.
Yeah. I think often as well, Larry, I think the big problem people have, especially this day and age, is that for a lot of people, they're afraid of saying they don't know or they don't understand it. And I think when we are talking about a subject such as this, people are very quick to dismiss it. They said they're not interested. I don't want to waste time on it. And for me, as someone that's always been very open-minded and always been deeply interested in all kinds of areas of science and technology and information and furthering our knowledge in regards to a variety of subjects, Larry, I can't get my head around that kind of attitude, regardless of what we're talking. When people just shut the conversation down or they don't want to do any research or investigation, I don't understand it, because you can't look at some of these cases and just go, yeah, well, that happened. Well, no, it clearly didn't.
It is perplexing. It is frustrating. It speaks volumes to the reality of xenophobia, fear of the unknown. Dr. Lester Adelson here in the United States, he was a medical examiner for Cuyahoga County out in Ohio, wrote an article about SHC debunking the whole concept. and we had a very lengthy telephone interview with him. And he was actually one of the TV shows we did for Canadian television. He was handed the photograph of Mrs. Conway and of Dr. Bentley. And his first response was, well, these are hoaxes. And asked why. He said, because bodies don't burn this way. So these photographs are obviously photoshopped or back in those days, you know, just simply airbrushed some way into a hoax. When we talked to Dr. Lester Addison, I said, you know, what is it that we are missing that you think you're seeing that would eliminate the mystery of what we think these fire scenes present? He just simply said, and this is a quote, I do not believe for a moment in the overheated concept of spontaneous human combustion, end quote. Okay, fine. But on what basis? We ask him, have you ever yourself gone out and investigated one of these cases firsthand? You are, after all, a medical examiner. You are, all, after all, having written negatively about the subject. Hmm. Did you ever actually go out and investigate or talk to a first responder? His answer was no. So he's arguing from ignorance. And in something that has the wealth of documentation that we have brought to the world in our book Ablaze and in cases that have happened since that book was published in 1995, arguing from ignorance is a really damning way to pursue your scientific career.
Oh, absolutely. I think the last case I want to touch on kind of sums up our standpoint on this, Larry, because I think we're clearly both singing from the same hymn sheet here. And some people may find this case ironic, but and there are a couple of things about this case that I find interesting when you have certain parallels. And this, once again, is a case of someone who's discovered due to their son not receiving a telephone call, which is a gentleman, I believe, who was called George Mott, who was found dead in 1986 in a log cabin. And he'd got a relationship with his son that they spoke every day. I think his son was called Kendall.
Correct. Yep.
And the irony of this, I suppose, for some people was twofold, really. I believe he was a fireman, wasn't he?
He was indeed.
And also, he was an ex-smoker. He'd actually stopped smoking several years prior to his sad demise. But once again, we have someone who has combusted entirely in bed, I believe he was, a wooden bed at that. And I remember seeing the scene, one of the photos from his scene, where the bed and the mattress, obviously there's a bit of burning there, but the wall's fine. I think there's a chest of drawers behind his bed head, which is completely untouched. And when you look at it, it's almost as if there's just like a hole in the mattress and it's just collapsed. It's remarkable.
It is remarkable. You, again, have described quite accurately the fire scene that Kendall Mott sort of encountered. Actually, Kendall never saw that. He walked partway into his dad's house and decided he couldn't go all the way to the back. But yeah, he sensed something had gone terribly awry, as indeed it had. George Mott was a retired firefighter in upstate New York in a little village called Crown Point outside of Ticonderoga. He met his baffling, flaming fate in late March of 1986. He was at one time a smoker, but for the last 10 years of his life, thereabouts, was an avowed, confirmed non-smoker. His son Kendall did smoke, and Kendall told us that he was not allowed to go inside his father's home and smoke. He had to go out on the porch to smoke a cigarette. So George Mott was, you know, really serious about this.
Yeah.
He was also extremely cautious about fire hazards in his 20 by 40 foot tinderbox of a cabin out on a rural highway outside of Crown Point. Meticulous. Everybody loved him that we spoke to who knew him. Didn't have an enemy in the world. And yet he managed to do, as did Mrs. Reeser, the impossible. Within about a 48-hour period, we've not been able to lock down the exact time, but somewhere within about 48 hours in late March of 86, Mr. Mott burned himself down through his mattress, down through the floorboards below the bed, and into the crawl space below, almost as did John Bentley in 1966 here in Pennsylvania. We got a call from the local fire investigator who knew of our research, and he said, if you want to come up and look at this, Larry, we're more than happy to have you do so. So we went up, worked with Tony Moret multiple times, worked with the county fire inspector, a brilliant gentleman who, when he served in the U.S. Air Force, had to deal with airmen who have been burned in jet fuel mishaps. And he said, those poor gentlemen were not nearly so consumed by jet fuel fire as had George Mott done all by himself without any accelerant.
Mm.
He left behind on that mattress one half of one leg at the other end of the bed headboard was his skull. According to Tony Moret, had shrunken in size to about that of a grapefruit, which is one of the descriptors that was said for Mrs. Reeser's head. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Human heads in high heat infernos do not shrink. They explode. At least that's been our experience in reading the literature. We have three cases in our database that suggest shrunken heads. Completely, completely inexplicable within mainstream conventional fire science.
Mm-hmm.
No odor of burned flesh again. A very low ceiling. We were at that fire scene two trips. We could touch the ceiling above the bed. Not a scorch mark on it, just as in the Bentley case, just as in the Reeser case. What else can we say about it? Very complex fire scene. There were other items in Mr. Mott's home that had melted or dehydrated or experienced quite anomalous thermal phenomena that we have not been able to understand ourselves, but at least we have thoroughly documented that fire scene. When the medical examiner arrived, they opened the refrigerator to find that the refrigerator was still running, but a stick of butter in the refrigerator had melted, which is kind of odd.
Yeah.
All the water in the toilet, and it looked like Mr. Mott had taken a bath before meeting his tragic fate, left a carbonized black sooting area in the bottom of the tub as if the tub had been wet at that area, but there's no water now. Whatever this process is appears to affect the water content of the body and the water that is in surroundings. The water vaporizes out of the body and out of the toilet and the bathtub in Mr. Mott's case, we believe.
Mm.
Clearly no accelerants were present. They were looked for by the local investigators. None could be found. When we talked to the BCI, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation in New York State, one of their officials said, yeah, we know how this happened. Oh, boy. Well, waiting. What's your answer? Yeah, it was an electrical fault. There was an electrical arc from the outlet that caught the mattress on fire, and poor Mr. Mott just happened to be lying on the mattress at the time, and it incinerated his body. Well, problem. That would make it a completely unique fire scene so far as we understand. But secondly, and more importantly, both we and the county fire investigators spent a lot of time collectively looking at all the electrical outlets in George Mott's bedroom. There was no indication whatsoever of an electrical fault or an arcing from any of those outlets that could have caught the mattress aflame and subsequently consumed Mr. Mott to powder. His ashes, ironically, were taken to the mortuary in the adjoining community of Burlington and cremated again. We called the cremation facility and said to verify that, because it struck us as bizarre, because that's what the death certificate said.
Yeah.
It said, yep, we cremated Mr. Mott's ashes. I said, must have been a pretty easy job because he didn't leave you much to burn. And he said, yep, you're right. So Mr. Mott was, despite him being basically naturally cremated, what little was left, basically the lower one leg and his shrunken head, was re-cremated, and then the ashes are scattered at sea. We spoke to the family. The last we were in contact with the Mott family, they were willing to acknowledge in their minds that their next of kin, Mr. Mott, had succumbed to spontaneous human combustion.
Yeah, it's a remarkable case. And I think I saw Kendall interviewed several years ago on a program, and he was adamant that in his mind, and to be fair, I think they spoke to some of the officials from the local authority as well, Larry. They were all of the opinion that something extremely strange had happened that night.
Yeah. This does not impact adversely on the family. It's just something that is so strange. And yes, it engenders fear and intimidation. And some people are clearly more comfortable not having to think about it.
Hmm.
But on the other hand, if science and human knowledge is to advance in its understanding, cases like this that are so well documented, they need to be explored and studied rather than being dismissed and covered up.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree, Larry. And I think we can only hope that we continue to push the boundaries of accepted explanation. And when we see problems, call them out for what they are, because that's the only way we're going to get to the bottom of this and find out what the hell is going on.
You are so correct. So correct. Thank you for saying that. We appreciate it.
No, you're very welcome. So, Larry, firstly, thank you so much for taking me on a nightmare trip into this phenomenon. As a former smoker, I'm even more glad I gave up now. But for anybody that wants to keep up to date with your work or get a hold of your fabulous book, Ablaze, which is packed full of information and first-hand witness testimony and photos and forensic examinations of the official explanations, as well as dropping you a line if they have any information about anything else that may come to their attention or give you any leads. How can everybody keep up to date and get hold of a copy of the book, Larry?
We would love to be in contact with your listeners for any of those reasons. The book is most easily available through Amazon. Just look for Larry Arnold and Ablaze, The Mysterious Fires of Spontaneous Human Combustion, and it will pop up. If you would like to get an autographed copy, contact us by email for that or for any other reason. That email address is shcHappens@gmail.com. Easy to remember. And the website, although it's not a very good one, but it will get you in touch with us and give you a little hint of a bit of what we've done in this area. That website is parascience.com, parascience.com. And of course, that'll link us to the email address and we can go from there. We welcome ideas, thoughts, leads, definitely leads. We have traveled the world tracking down these amazing cases and trying to document them and find enough information that will help us narrow down the hypotheses into a few less than 120 plus. The mystery is there. The fascination is there. Yes, it's scary. Yes, it's intimidating. It's the perfect Halloween theme to explore. But it happens throughout the year. It happens to both males and females, mostly to the old, but also to the very young. And the mystery awaits a solution.
Well, long may you keep continue to push those boundaries, and I hope we get to the bottom of it one day, Larry. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. I will put links to your website and where people can get hold of a copy of the book in the show notes. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining me and expanding my knowledge on this wonderful subject.
Paul, you're most welcome, and we appreciate you being so well-informed on the subject. It took us in some fascinating directions together, and we trust your podcast listeners will enjoy it as much as we have enjoyed discussing the topic with you tonight.